This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the U.S. goes all out for regime change in Venezuela. A new book challenges the dominant discourse on AIDS. And what's taking Bernie Sanders so long to declare himself a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination?
But first, Black activists in Chicago are determined to defeat many members of the city's 50-person Board of Aldermen, only one of whom supports community control of the police. Last month, Frank Chapman, co-chair of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, predicted that by the end of January, the movement would recruit at least 70 candidates who are pledged to support creation of a civilian police accountability commission. We spoke with Chapman again this week.
The count is now, we have 78 for the city council, and we have 4 for the mayoral seat, for the mayor. So the count is up to 82 total.
So you've exceeded your predictions, but how firm are these endorsements of CPAC?
Well, most of them are firm, except there's some question about some of the mayoral candidates, but most of them are firm. The firmest mayoral candidate that we have is LaShawn Ford, who is formerly a state assemblyman, who's running because he's been involved around the Laquan McDonald struggle for a number of years. And then a write-in candidate, Reverend Katharine Brown. Now, the rest of them, we don't know because they have not really been involved in the movement. And most of the aldermanic candidates, or candidates for city council, are African-Americans who have been involved in the movement and who are really about making some changes in that city council. They're not professional politicians. Most of them come from the community. A lot of them are community activists. And so we expect great things from them. But we're not pushing any candidate as a politician. We're pushing the issue. And we're educating our community to understand that they are valuable to us so long as they represent us and carry the issue forward. If they do not do that, then we are prepared to mobilize and organize against them just like we have against the incumbents.
Now, I've seen you make reference to the movement for CPAC having 55,000 supporters. Where's that number come from?
That number comes from years of us organizing in the community. We table in the community every weekend. We go out in the streets and we talk to people. We engage them and we get them to sign up as supporters. That's where that number comes from. These are people that we've actually talked to, who know what CPAC is and who knew what they were joining, people who solidly support CPAC.
And you've asked these people now to engage in this electoral activity.
Absolutely have. We have the number of our supporters broke down into wards. We have an average of 1,000 supporters in 25 wards, and we have some supporters in all 50 wards. But we have an average of 1,000 supporters in 25 wards. So what we do with the candidates who are running, who are CPAC candidates, we give them a list of our supporters in their ward, and we help them mobilize those people.
And those people who have not endorsed CPAC, will your folks be actively working against them?
We most definitely will. In fact, not will be. We are working actively against them right now, as I speak. We are campaigning against them.
Now, this drive to make a friendlier council to CPAC was pushed into high gear after the victory in getting a conviction of the cop that killed Laquan McDonald. But since that time, there have been a couple of setbacks.
Yes, the Chicago three-step, one step forward, two steps backwards. We took a very definite step forward in getting Jason Van Dyke convicted. We took two steps backwards with the sentencing of Jason Van Dyke, which was ridiculous because he was facing a minimum of 96 years based on the jury convicting him of 16 separate aggravated assault charges based on each gunshot wound that he pumped into Laquan McDonald's body. The judge literally threw that out and only considered the second-degree murder charge for sentencing, which means that he gave him the minimum amount of things that he could give him, 81 months, and that's ridiculous. In fact, we maintain it's a violation of the mandatory sentencing statutes that they use all the time to send black folk and Latinos in the city to jail. So we are supporting the Attorney General, Kwame Rao, in his efforts to get this sentence repealed.
And the three cops that were charged with helping cover up the killing of Laquan McDonald, they were acquitted.
You know, that business as usual in Chicago, because every single time that there's a judge trial, there's a bench trial of police officers, they get acquitted. 100% of the time, they get acquitted. So this was no exception. You know, we weren't expecting these cops to get convicted because they had a bench trial. And these judges here are corrupt. The only reason why Jason Van Dyke got convicted is because he had a jury trial. They thought they could get away with a jury trial because they put mostly white people on the jury and only had one black person on there. But the jury fooled them. The jury was convinced by the evidence to convict him. Unfortunately, we can't repeal or we can't get the courts to retry those three cops that got off because there would be double jeopardy. But what we can do, we can pressure the federal authorities to indict them under federal statutes. That hasn't happened in a long time. And given this administration, it's not likely to happen now. But, you know, people demonstrate and protest under dictatorships in other countries. So we're going to still make our demands. We're not going to stop making our demands just because Trump is in the White House. We'll still make our demands.
And you just came from an important court case this morning.
Yes, it really has me angry. This brother, Gerald Reed, has spent 28 years in prison for something that he did not do. He's a torture survivor under the John Birch regime. Back in the 90s, he was tortured and put into prison. The court, in an evidentiary hearing, found that his confession was coerced. They mean the same thing. They mean torture. And threw it out. And so he now, presently, has no conviction. His conviction was thrown out. But these special prosecutors, so-called special prosecutors operating for the state of Illinois, have decided to retry him. And so today we were there to try to get him out on bail because he deserves to get out on bail if they're going to retry him. And the judge didn't show up because of the weather. So we got to go back on February the 15th. But this is a horrific example of how the state of Illinois is treating those people whom they have unjustly imprisoned for years, for decades. We don't only have Gerald Reed. We have over 100 torture survivors who are still locked up that we need to get out. And so we're demanding that the governor of this state give all of them a pardon because they could be going through this forest of the criminal justice system here in Chicago for another 100 years, and they're not all going to live that long.
So here we have a person who was tortured by the police. The courts recognized that he was tortured, and yet there is no prejudice against the state to stop them from trying him again.
Yeah, isn't that ridiculous? When it comes to black people, what we have morphed into here in this country, and it wasn't a slow gradual process, it's been going on for a long time, is a virtual police state. This is the stuff that they tell us happens in countries where they have police states. Well, forget about all that. This is happening in the United States. And it's happening to us. It's happening to our community. It's happening to our people. This is because we have no rights that they are bound to respect.
And in Chicago, and in virtually every other city in the country, a black establishment has arisen that is totally comfortable with that police state and helps facilitate its actions.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate, but we're not satisfied with that either. You know, it's not just about them being black. It's about what they stand for. And right now, they're standing against us, so they can't use their color. They're standing against us, and we are against them. That's why we're trying to change the city council. We will no longer accept people representing us, but not representing us. But now we're going to heighten and intensify the fight back to make sure that the government in this city as far as black participation is concerned, changes.
And when is Election Day?
It's going to be this month, February.
So do you think you've got what they used to call the momentum?
Oh, we got the momentum. You asked me about how many supporters we had. I told you 55,000. So we're not just counting people putting their signature on a postcard or putting their signature on a petition or telling us that they support us. We're not just counting that. Now we're counting votes. Now we're having something in this city that we have never had before. Now we're having a referendum on community control of the police. And that is very important, and that is politically powerful. Because if we win this referendum, then this opens up the door for community control of our schools. In fact, as I said to you earlier, this creates a path to self-determination in the black community.
Now, CPAC has been endorsed by the teachers union in Chicago. How helpful have they been? How closely are they working with you in this aldermanic and mayoral campaign?
Well, the CTU, the teachers union, is working very closely with us. They endorsed CPAC 3 years ago, and they've been side by side with us. They've put as many as 30,000 people in the streets supporting us. So they are a good ally, and we're proud to have them with us.
That was Frank Chapman, co-chair of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression.
The Trump administration has seized billions of dollars in Venezuela's holdings in the United States and signed the money over to a Venezuelan opposition politician named Juan Guaido, who named himself president of the country last week. The U.S. is attempting to cripple Venezuela's economy in order to overthrow the socialist government that has repeatedly won free and fair elections over the past 20 years. Joe Emmersberger has written frequently on the U.S. campaign for regime change in Venezuela.
Since August, you know, Trump imposed these financial sanctions that have cost the Venezuelan economy about $6 billion, or actually the Venezuelan government, $6 billion roughly of lost revenue just in the first year after they were imposed. So that's already making a real huge economic catastrophe that they're going through much worse. And now they've ramped it up to another level. You know, the whole point of this recognition of Guaido as president, which is nuts for so many reasons, is that it allows them basically to impose a de facto embargo on the oil revenues, because now they say that, well, you guys can keep shipping us oil. In fact, at one point, they even mocked them, saying, yeah, go ahead and ship us oil, but we're sending the money to Guaido and whoever he appoints. So it's basically a way to cut off the oil revenue. So this is monstrous. Francisco Rodriguez is one, he's an opposition guy, and he's actually on board with this, I'm sad to say. But he have projected an 11-point contraction next year in the economy. But as soon as this all came into effect with recognizing Guaido, he upped that to like 26% contraction. So, you know, another 15 percentage points of GDP that'll be lost as a result of this de facto embargo. So it's just absolutely monstrous. And it will kill people, you know, as Mark Weisbrot pointed out in an op-ed today, because it's deprived the government of the currency they need for imports that are crucial to the people, you know, foods, medicine, stuff like that.
Since Venezuela gets most of its foreign exchange from oil, how will the government operate?
It's going to have to find people to sell oil to at a very discounted rate. If they're going to keep sending it to the United States, they're just throwing their oil away because the United States is going to block the revenues. So I suppose one option would be, well, to default on any debts they have as much as they can, not pay bondholders as much as they can. And also find ways to place the oil cheaply in other places besides the United States. Well, that's going to be difficult because the United States is going to try to threaten those people for dealing with them in some way. You know, the United States with its financial clout and its willing, you know, it's got like a coalition of the willing again, you know, like it had with Iraq. It's worth people remembering that back in Iraq, two of the countries that went along with that are Denmark and Norway. So even countries with quite progressive reputations, you know, but when it comes to imperialism, when it comes to crushing countries in the global south, you know, they go right along with it.
The United States has virtually handed the keys to all of Venezuela's assets frozen in the United States. And the British have frozen, seized Venezuela's gold bullion.
Yeah, the Bank of England's refused to send back like over $1 billion worth of gold that the government, Maduro's government, has requested to repatriate. They've just refused. And they've also recognized Guaido. They're following along with the United States. Like I said, it's just another coalition of the willing all over again. just like in Iraq. And it's just as monstrous a lie. It's a lie that Venezuela is not a democracy. I mean, you know, when you use that, when you use the word democracy about any real world government, including the United States, you know, you're talking very loosely in the sense that there are contested elections. There is a press where the government can be aggressively criticized, all that stuff, all the rule, basic rules that you're supposed to play by to be called a democracy. Venezuela follows that, but it doesn't matter. They just declare them a dictatorship, and then that supposedly frees them up to do whatever they want to.
Yes, but much of the opposition has long ago opted for regime change with the assistance of the United States.
Yeah. Now, there's some parts of the opposition that are more willing to play the electoral game. But even that moderate branch, I have to say, when it sees the opportunity to get the government overthrown, they tend to go along with it. Henry Falcon, he ran in the election in May of 2018. And he lost it. He lost it badly by like 4 million votes. I mean, Maduro won easily. I mean, there was a low turnout because the opposition, much of the leadership, refused to run and told its supporters not to run and not to vote, and also attacked Falcon, viciously attacked Falcon, and said he was basically in a conspiracy with Maduro. So they deliberately undermined that election, and he lost it. So the question is, I see people saying, you know, the election was rigged. So what does that mean? Who won it then? You notice they don't declare Falcon the president, right? I mean, they have their handpicked guy. If they're saying the election was rigged, then they should be able to prove that Falcon actually won it. And of course they can't. They don't even try to do that because he lost it so badly. So instead they just arbitrarily pick a guy who didn't even run. I mean, it's just the height of absurdity.
The Trump administration says that it's going to funnel first $20 million in what it calls humanitarian aid through this hand-picked opposition lawmaker, Guaido. How does that work, and why is Guaido allowed to still walk the streets of Caracas while collaborating so openly with a foreign power to overthrow his government?
Well, you know, when you have the world's biggest bully, biggest gangster standing behind you, you can do a lot, right? I mean, if the Godfather tells you, you know, you don't touch this guy or we're going to come have you whacked, well, then you're going to be very careful, right? So, I mean, that's what the opposition's counted on all along. They do things that it's been an insurrectionary government. They overthrew Chavez for 2 days. And, you know, one of the big complaints is that two of the guys who participated in that coup, a guy named Enrique Capriles and another guy, Leopoldo Lopez, and they went on to carry other attempts to overthrow the government by force too. And, you know, the big complaint against Maduro is that these guys weren't allowed to run in 2018. Well, I mean, in the United States, people who tried to do something like that, they wouldn't be concerned about running for office there. That would be the least of their worries. You know, they'd be at best imprisoned and never heard from again. But yeah, you know, when you have the biggest bully on the block behind you, you can get away with things. So the Venezuelan government has to be very careful. You know, they don't want to give Trump and his allies, this coalition of the willing again, this excuse to launch an attack on the country.
You note that we're coming up on the 15th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Haiti and its kidnapping of Haiti's elected president. I'm sure you bring that up because of the threat that is now presented to Venezuela.
Well, yeah, that coup is really horrible. Is that, again, it shows that democratic legitimacy, you know, playing by the rules, really doesn't offer you much defense at all when the whole Western propaganda system starts kicking in the gear and telling you you're illegitimate, you're not really a democracy. And that's what they did with Aristide. And in that case, it wasn't even a U.S.-backed coup. You know, we've seen a lot of U.S.-backed coups in the region, but this was actually perpetrated by U.S. troops. And it was backed by France and Canada. Again, they provided a lot of support because at that time, Bush was so widely discredited around the world because of his invasion of Iraq. So it really helps to have allies who come in there and give you cover and make it seem like, hey, it's not just this Bush guy who nobody really trusts or like. It's, you know, it's these other guys who have better reputations. You know, Canada and France were not part of the coalition of the willing against Iraq. So it helped that those two countries went along with the coup in Haiti. And also Canada, it's another point that has to be made, is to it, even though Canada wasn't officially part of the coalition, you know, this author, Canadian author, Eve Zangler, has done a lot of good work showing that they contributed a hell of a lot. In fact, probably more than a lot of the countries that were officially part of that coalition of the willing in Iraq. So, you know, when, you know, you talk U.S. imperialism, you know, it depends. I think to an extent that people don't often understand. Now, these so-called allies, you know, these very rich and powerful countries that, you know, have basically the same shared worldview overall, a very bigoted worldview that says we can just tell the lesser breeds what they have to do.
Well, the socialist government in Venezuela has something that Aristide in Haiti didn't have, and that is 1 million persons in its armed militia ready to defend the government.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fact. I mean, that's important, but it's also very scary because Maduro has a hardcore base of millions of people, probably 30%. You know, very solid support. And yeah, a lot of people armed are willing to defend themselves. And also, if these guys come to power, especially if they come to power through a coup, then they're not going to want to just ignore this base. They're going to want to eradicate them as a political force. It could easily be similar to what happened in the dirty wars that we had in Argentina and, you know, in Chile, where they basically, through mass murder, seek to eradicate them as a political force. And in Central America, of course, during the 80s. So that's a really horrifying prospect. I mean, and what's also horrifying about it is that the ease with which the corporate media can bury that, you know, can just ignore it. I mean, that's why countries like Colombia, for example, are portrayed as benign, respectable democracies, when if you look into them a bit, you know that there are just horrendous things going on all the time that no one really talks about.
Can we see that kind of dirty war, which would have to be far more bloodthirsty in Venezuela than even in Brazil and Chile? Can that kind of dirty war go on in today's Latin America without actually undermining other regimes around the continent?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, the Colombian civil war has kind of wound down, but it's still not totally extinguished by any means. And yeah, sure, it could affect things in a lot of unpredictable ways that nobody could really say. But I mean, there is definitely a possibility of a really gruesome outcome here if the United States gets its way, or if it doesn't get its way, but it just continues this like medieval siege of Venezuela that's trying to do through these maneuvers, like blocking the oil revenues and stuff. So yeah, it's very, very bad, and there needs to be, you know, we got to push back. We have to push back against this propaganda that has removed any moral constraint, any moral or legal constraint on what the government can do, on what the U.S. government can do.
The Maduro government probably does have only minority support in Venezuela today after these years of economic hardship, but that wasn't always the case. Under Hugo Chavez, the government was very popular. Why didn't the Chavez government crack down on the oligarchy, which continues to control much of the economy and much of the media?
Yeah, you know, in hindsight, I definitely think he should have taken much more radical moves, especially with the media. You know, to set up a media that wasn't necessarily government controlled, but not controlled by the oligarchs either. I think there are ways, you know, Robert McChesney has promoted a way. I think that's very good, this idea of vouchers. I think the Chavistas could have done something like that, created a media that to replace the oligarchs, but also not have the traditional state media, which also has problems. So I think they could have done things like that. They could have done a lot of things better. I mean, there was the exchange rate system was something that actually Chavez left in place, but it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't doing the damage that it did under Maduro. But there's always things that any government can do better. But, you know, in retrospect, they achieved a lot. You know, not only did they just basically survive, they survived all the coup, you know, the two major coup attempts while Chavez was in office in 2002 and the other one that went into 2003 with the oil sabotage. I mean, not only did he survive those, but he actually reduced poverty by half, extreme poverty by two-thirds. He did a lot of really good things, but his strategy, I think, was to kind of not go overboard, not try to go too hard against the traditional elites, because, you know, he didn't want to provoke another coup and, you know, tried to play by the rules, gave them an amnesty after the coup attempt. That's why a lot of these guys, they would have been in the U.S., you know, locked up for basically forever at best. So, you know, in retrospect, there's always things that could have been better. But I think where we need to focus is how we in the imperial countries, in the big imperial countries, need to be better, because this whole propaganda campaign should never got off the ground. And so that's on us. You know, that's on our inability here to get something better going with more democratic movements, more democratic media especially.
Yes, here in the United States, virtually all of the Democratic Party, with just a few exceptions, is either cheering Guaido and his coup plotters mm-hmm. and the United States' support of him, or ambivalent, as Bernie Sanders seems to be.
Yeah, you know, what bothers me personally is that Maduro's government in Venezuela has as much right to be called a democracy as the United States. If I had to cherry pick every single thing about the United States that's undemocratic, you know, from mass incarceration, you know, police killing, you know, the whole electoral college, the money, I mean, just go on and on and on. You could list a whole bunch of things. And you present that, you could present that to somebody, you know, say, you know, who's never been to the United States and doesn't speak English, and tell them, look, the United States is a dictatorship. Well, you could make a pretty good case, you know, and that's kind of what they've done with Venezuela. They've just spoon-fed people over almost two decades now, very one-sided information. Even when it has been accurate, which is sometimes, oftentimes has not been, but even when it has been, it's been very one-sided, very misleading.
Yes, well, if the Democratic Party is pro-coup, where is the defense of Venezuela here in the United States?
Yeah, you know, there's, I think, one congresswoman who's pushing back hard. What bothers me is I don't see, like I was mentioning about Sanders, he basically accepts this whole premise. He makes clear that he accepts this ridiculous premise that Venezuela somehow doesn't have democratic legitimacy, that Maduro's government doesn't have democratic legitimacy. And that really bothers me because there's no reason to accept that. There's no reason to accept that as true. It's not, especially when you consider the conditions that the government is under. I mean, a government's being threatened militarily, has been for, you know, two decades almost, by a much stronger foreign power. I mean, in the United States. And there's no democracy that's obliged to let itself be overthrown by a foreign government. That's not any reasonable definition of democracy.
Russia and, to a lesser extent, China have pledged their solidarity with Venezuela. But what can they do to forestall not just a coup, but a U.S. military action from so far away?
I think, actually, China could do a lot. I don't know if they will, if they'll think it's worth it for them. I mean, I'm happy that they're at least blocking the more outrageous positions that the United States would pursue if they weren't opposed, like they did, you know, like they basically stepped aside in Libya, and we see what happened there. But this is even worse because Venezuela, like I say, is a democratically elected government. But China, with, I think, still has like $3 trillion in reserves or something like that, they could do a lot to offset the damage. But is it important enough to them? Will Maduro's government make the right moves to get some help there? I hope so. But China, to me, is the best hope. I hope something happens there, but I don't know if it will.
That was journalist Joe Emmersberger.
The Democrats already have a sizable number of declared presidential candidates. However, Bernie Sanders, the man who almost defeated Hillary Clinton in the 2016 primaries and who polls show is the most popular politician in the country, has yet to declare his candidacy. We spoke with Danny Haifong, who writes a weekly column for Black Agenda Report.
Yeah, and Bernie Sanders has also been relatively quiet other than pursuing almost down low campaign support from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's media team. He hasn't made any formal announcement of his campaign just yet for 2020, but he is still the most popular Democratic Party politician in the country, maybe even the most popular politician in the country still, despite 4 years away from the debacle that was last election's 2016 Democratic primary that was basically stolen by Hillary Clinton. And I think there's a reason why Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, most recently, who announced his candidacy on the first day of Black History Month, I think there's a reason why they are now coming into the field. And I think that's because the Democratic Party establishment is really trying to flood the primary with its own faces and its own preferred candidates in order to paralyze the Sandinistas, to split the vote to people like Elizabeth Warren, who's more moderate than Sanders on every single issue, even Wall Street, or someone like Kamala Harris, who is much more preferred to the ruling class than even an Elizabeth Warren, who's very light rhetoric around regulating Wall Street is too much for many on the elite and establishment side of the Democrats. So I think we have to follow this closely because Cory Booker, we all know, he's had Black Agenda Report, has been covering him for years in regards to his deep connections to the charter school privatization industries, to the big pharma behemoth, which in 2017 and 18 became a huge issue for him when he decided to shoot down a very popular proposal by Bernie Sanders to make generic medications in the United States cheaper through connections to Canada. So we know where these candidates stand, and we also know that it's not their time right now. We know where the electorate, in terms of Democrats, stand, voters, in terms of wanting Medicare for all, things like reduced student debt, forgiveness, as well as things like higher wages. We know that these candidates like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, even Elizabeth Warren will talk about these things, but we know that they're not genuine. So I think the purpose of them in terms of their participation is to split the Sandinistas apart in preparation for the 2020 primary, which I think the Democratic Party elite really doesn't want to see another repeat of 2016 when Hillary Clinton damn near destroyed, or actually did destroy, the Democratic Party's meager popularity.
So it seems to be incumbent on Bernie Sanders to get out there in the race sooner than he might have anticipated, so that the corporate media can't make him appear to be irrelevant.
And we would think that he would have already by now, just given the developments of the 2018 midterms, where a lot of these left-ish candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, the Palestinian woman from Michigan. But there was almost a continuation of the upsurge that was watered down to a degree, but ultimately represented the same trend that certain political issues need to be talked about now on the Democratic Party side. They can no longer avoid questions of health care, question of wages. The conditions on the ground in the United States are just so dire. So ultimately, you would think that he would want to announce his bid now in order to build momentum for the impending attack to come. But really, even his public stances on things like Venezuela appear to be confused and ultimately don't serve him much benefit in terms of ruling class support, which he never has tried ultimately to garner through his political organizing and campaign organizing. In 2016, he was mostly supported, if not entirely supported, by small donations, fringe labor unions that went against the grain of the Democratic Party establishment, and other left-ish organizing forces that put a lot of energy into his campaign to ensure that it had a grassroots quality. And so positions on, like he's taken with Venezuela, which appear to be presidential positions, right, opposing Maduro, opposing the government of Venezuela, while at the same time stating he is against regime change. These things are ultimately geared towards the electoral arena, but they don't make much sense because they don't really set him apart in the way that I think he thinks they do. I think it shows that he tries to toe the line on imperialism and questions of imperialism with the ruling class on the one hand, while at the same time, he tries to flank left in order to garner support from his old time and what he hopes will be new supporters in the 2020 race. However, I think he's miscalculating. And so if he doesn't get in soon, he's going to find that figures like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, who are honestly on their first trial run for president, they will be back, I'm sure, if they aren't able to garner enough support this time around. He's going to find that it will be difficult for an older white male who has a very damaged reputation with the Democratic Party already for him to build the same momentum. So I think he needs to get out there now.
Yes, the early Democratic primaries in the South, those are considered to be de facto black primaries. Last time around, by the time those primaries came up, Bernie Sanders still had a very low name recognition level in the black community. But the polls show that blacks are more in favor of Bernie Sanders than white voters are. So name recognition won't be the problem.
No, it won't be. And Sanders was already, I think recently, he was in South Carolina along with other primary candidates like Kamala Harris, courting the black political class there for their support, because South Carolina, as you said, is a critical state. But yeah, there is this misconception, I think, in the Democratic Party establishment, Wall Street and military industrial complex donors in the corporate media. They like to promote Bernie Sanders as someone who just can't relate to black people in the United States. And that was really proven wrong, especially among young black voters in 2016. They really pushed Bernie Sanders' agenda to the forefront. I mean, I was not in New York City yet when he spoke in the mostly black, mostly Latino borough of the Bronx here. And there were tens of thousands of residents and students and others who attended that. And it definitely showed that his agenda had wide appeal. And I think that's not going to be a problem for him, even though we know how the Democratic Party establishment likes to play it. They're going to try to show off their diversity, their con of diversity with Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, especially to show that they are the party of black folks. And we know exactly who these candidates are. Kamala Harris, a virtual prison guard and cop for the ruling class, and Cory Booker, who's basically a black Republican who's always posed as a Democrat, but has supported the same forces that even Republicans have come out strongly for, especially things like vouchers and school segregation, the old school style.
Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, is the only Democratic office holder who's a candidate for president of the United States that is a true anti-war candidate. She, in fact, has held talks with the president of Syria.
Yes, Tulsi Gabbard is, again, I did not mention her, but she is also going to make the primary very interesting for the Democratic Party establishment, because, and I think also very interesting for Bernie Sanders as well, because Tulsi Gabbard, while not a Sandernista necessarily in her own right, she has been likely the most left-wing Democratic Party candidate in a long time on issues of foreign policy. When it comes to her position on Syria, she introduced the bill, I forget if it was in 2016 or a little bit before then, she introduced the Stop Arming Terrorists Act into Congress, which didn't really get much attention at the time, but it was a critical bill because it exposed the way that the U.S. intelligence agencies and the U.S. military, as well as its allies, were literally arming terrorists in the region, especially in Syria, to overthrow the Syrian government. And as you said, she has met with the democratically elected government of Bashar al-Assad. And so that's going to make this very interesting, because Bernie Sanders, he has often touted himself as anti-regime change. However, on a lot of questions when it comes to imperialism, he has really stuck to the ruling class line, especially in regards to Syria and places like Venezuela. I think a lot of us remember during the presidential primary debates in 2016, and when Sanders called Hugo Chavez, socialist, the former president, and Hugo Chavez a dead communist dictator. And he has continued that line about Venezuela. He has created his own axis of evil, as you pointed out, Glenn, a while back, where he has targeted countries like the DPRK as threats to U.S. security. So we know that Tulsi Gabbard, even though she is likely not to receive the same grassroots support as Sanders, she's not likely to receive ruling class support from the military-industrial complex in Wall Street, we know she's going to make the debates especially very interesting for Sanders and establishment Democrats alike.
Now, of course, Bernie Sanders is most known for his support for Medicare for All, as well as free college tuition. And Medicare for All is fantastically popular. Something like 85% of Democrats support Medicare for All, and about half of the Republicans support it. So this has become a kind of litmus test that is at least voicing support for Medicare for All for Democratic presidential candidates. But Cory Booker has received more money than any other senator from Big Pharma. So his endorsements of Medicare for All certainly isn't credible.
Yes, it definitely is not credible. And that goes for Republicans and Democrats alike in terms of the support he has received from big pharmaceutical corporations. And I think this is a pattern with the Democratic Party establishment candidates that are coming up in the 2020 primary season. They, all of them, have endorsed some form of Medicare for All in rhetoric. But we know that Kamala Harris comes out of California, where the pharmaceutical giants and the healthcare insurance industries are huge donors of most of the political class there. And she herself has the reputation of saying one thing, like she's against the banks, while in secret, kind of like Hillary Clinton in the 2016 elections, in secret, she negotiated sweetheart deals with corporations such as West One, Steve Mnuchin's old a corporation that was found to do all sorts of illegal things in terms of evictions and really squeezing the people of California. So we know that none of the positions of the candidates that are going to come up are credible. Sanders, because of his base, even if Sanders, regardless of what's going on in his head, he's genuine or not as an individual, we know his base is very, in terms of the Sandernistas, is very credible in terms of what they want. They showed it through their deep grassroots support for his candidacy in 2016. We know that they are genuine and that they likely know that these candidates are not actually for Medicare for All like Bernie Sanders could be if he were to run. So the real question will be, how will the Sandernistas fare should Sanders eventually announce his candidacy, which I think we're all expecting him to do? Will they be split up into fragmented pieces because these candidates against Sanders will be speaking a new game that Hillary Clinton just couldn't do in the 2016 elections? Or will they hunker down and firmly support Sanders and create a real crisis of legitimacy again, like what happened in 2016 elections, which will possibly open the way for another 4 years of Trump, but also sow and spread the disillusion that I think millions upon millions of people in the United States are feeling around the U.S. electoral system and just who it serves.
Yes, the Democrats live in an acute contradiction. The corporate forces that support the Democratic Party, that provide the billions of dollars in campaign funds and ultimately call the tune, offer the public, offer the American people only austerity and war. And there's no room there for Medicare for All or reconstructing the country. There's no room for anything except austerity. So the Democrats must promise to be doing something, but not really be specific about what that something is.
Exactly. And it speaks to a larger systemic crisis, the crisis of the global imperialist system. We know through the understanding that the two-party duopoly can offer nothing but austerity and war is a product of the fact that the advent of high-tech capital, the advent of big finance capital that has swallowed the system of capitalism as a whole, is no longer able to offer these things without cutting into its profit margins. And we know that the for-profit system of capitalism is incapable of doing that. So there really is the era of concessions is over. And I think for a generation of experience now, almost two generations now of experience of endless austerity and war, is the ultimate reflection of that. And the Democratic Party is in a big contradiction that's turning into an antagonism, as you said, because it is the party that is supposed to represent the left-ish forces and the legitimate left forces that have existed in the United States, whether that is the working class struggle reflected in the labor movement that has since abandoned the working class, or for the most part, or the black radical tradition, the black left tradition, which the Democrats have tried to pander to for the last several decades as the so-called party of the civil rights movement. But we know when the Democratic Leadership Council emerged during the Clinton era that even the posture of being the party of civil rights ended, and it became the party of the super predator, austerity, and mass incarceration regime. And so, yes, the Democratic Party is in big trouble right now. I think that it is very desperate in terms of how it's going to wrestle control away from the big orange, unpredictable menace of Donald Trump. And I think it knows that the trouble that it is having in terms of trying to pin some fabricated Russiagate scandal, Russian collusion scandal on him without being able to criticize his actual policies and the policies of administration, that really point to the fact that the Democratic Party is really on the Trump administration side on a lot of things and can't dare question these things lest it be held accountable for all of the policies and all of the practices that it is ultimately contributing to and leading in a lot of ways, including endless war abroad, which it has proudly resisted any of Trump's calls for a more eased relationship with Russia or the end to regime change, quote unquote, abroad.
That was Black Agenda Report columnist Danny Haifeng.
Darius Boast is a professor of ethnic studies at the School for Cultural and Social Transformation at the University of Utah. His most recent book was featured in the Bar Books Forum. It's titled Evidence of Being: The Black Gay Cultural Renaissance and the Politics of Violence. Professor Boast says he wants to challenge the dominant queer theoretical discourse that says the AIDS crisis is over.
In the mid-1990s, there were several reports that were released in major magazines, many by prominent white gay activists, that suggested that the AIDS crisis was over. And much of that discourse surrounded the invention of cocktails that made change the HIV/AIDS from being a death sentence or not having a cure to a manageable chronic illness. But for African Americans who became much more affected, for people of color in general, Blacks and Latinos, that the sort of access to healthcare, also sort of exacerbated by issues of poverty, the AIDS still remains a crisis. Black, gay, and bisexual men and transgender women are disproportionately affected. Black men are still dying of AIDS and have the most disproportionate deaths. So, yes, the discourse that AIDS is over because it's now a manageable chronic illness does not apply to people of color who still struggle around healthcare and health access in general.
Well, certainly AIDS has been reduced as a priority or is no priority at all to the current administration in the White House. President right. Trump has fired his advisor on AIDS.
Yes. Yeah, that was one of the first things he did when he got into the White House. And if you look at some of the early work of organizations like ACT UP, New York AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, they actually went after Donald Trump because they were concerned that he was getting money to build Trump Tower in New York at the time when people were dying of AIDS and they were losing their housing and having to live on the street. And many people sort of parodied Donald Trump in that moment. Some part of me, given his larger sort of rhetoric of revenge, especially directed towards Barack Obama, suggests that part of that motivation had to do with sort of earlier responses and attacks on him because of his sort of wealth accumulation during a moment, the heightened moment of the AIDS crisis.
Now, your book focuses on the activism and artistry that was employed by gay Black men back during the first part of the crisis. The crisis is ongoing, of course. You seem to be saying that this group of people refused to allow the politics to be taken out of this situation.
Yeah. Part of the reason that I wanted to talk about this movement, and I sort of take my cue from Kathy Cohen, whose really important book that was published in 1999, The Boundaries of Blackness, AIDS and the Breakdown of Black Politics, which is coming up on its 20th year anniversary. she talks about the three stages of AIDS activism in Black communities, and she identifies many of the writers that I talk about, folks like Essex Hemphill, groups like Other Countries Collective, Joseph Beam, as being a part of the first stage of AIDS activism in Black communities. Much of that work was grassroots activism that did not rely on the state, because at that moment, Black folks were still illegible as AIDS victims because the dominant discourse was focused on white gay men, even though there were reports that suggested that Black women and men of color were subjected and IV drug users. Much of the discourse was still surrounding white gay men. And much of this grassroots activism, because it was centered in Black communities, sort of emphasized that we could not get rid of AIDS without getting rid of stigma. And that still persists today. And so they were challenging homophobia. They were challenging racism. They were also challenging capitalism, because they knew that it was poverty that was exacerbating the AIDS epidemic in Black communities. So part of my emphasis on telling history is for us to think about the ways in which, as AIDS becomes more, or AIDS services and organizations became more bureaucratized, as Cohen tells us, and becomes more connected to the state and the CDC and grant funding, that some of those emphases on ending racism, homophobia, capitalism are lost in that. So I want to, for us to return and think about that those things are still needed, because the stigma is still there.
So you want to reopen this conversation about the convergence of racial trauma and sexual trauma?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you look at least within sort of scholarly discourse, and I would say in more popular discourse as well, I mean, of course, right now, most salient is sort of concerns about police violence and mass incarceration. And often when we talk about African-American trauma, right, we talk about slavery, we talk about Jim Crow, we talk about lynching, and every now and again, we may talk about rape. I think Danielle McGuire's book on the civil rights movement and many sort of Black feminist scholars who are talking about women and lynching have shifted the discourse a bit. But AIDS, right, remains marginal to me within a larger discourse of African-American trauma, even though it continues to disproportionately impact Black people all over the globe. It is a Black crisis. I'm actually editing a special issue of the journal Souls right now with Marlon Bailey, that when we titled it the Black AIDS Epidemic, to center AIDS within Black trauma, part of the reason I believe that it continues to be marginalized within African-American discourse, political discourse, is because it still impacts the most marginal members of our community, right? The queer, the trans, the sex workers, the poor. And it's time out for us to be leaving those folks behind. That's what Cohen was talking about 20 years ago. And we're still dealing with those issues now.
Well, Black Lives Matter has called unprecedented attention in terms of the Black community to gender issues, but you don't think that they've focused enough on AIDS and its specific impact in Black America?
I mean, I just saw Charlene Carruthers. She just came to my university, University of Utah, yesterday, and she reminded me that the sort of movement for Black Lives is an umbrella, right, for multiple organizations. And I think that AIDS is a concern. I think they're fighting on multiple fronts, but I do not see AIDS as being as prominent within Black political discourse as it should be, given the amount of people killed from AIDS are more so than those who are killed by police violence. And I don't want to make that kind of comparison. It's hard to do such, but it is something that is still killing us. And I think that it has to be more central in our movement for Black lives.
You write that the field of Black studies, and you think the Black community more broadly, is haunted by melancholy. What do you mean, melancholy?
I mean, we are forced every day to witness, right, the injustices of murders of Black people, of injustice for even after their murder, that people are not indicted. And, you know, we witness every day kinds of discrimination. It circulates virally. I mean, I think that has to affect us. Elizabeth Alexander, the prominent poet and also cultural theorist, wrote an important piece in the 1990s that asked, can you be Black and look at this? And she talked about the sort of the publicness of violations of the Black body is actually what produces our collective feelings of Blackness. And that feeling to me is one of melancholy. And I know it impacts me negatively, sometimes not wanting to leave my home. But I feel like that feeling of melancholy has become pervasive in African-American studies, in much of the discourse that does not see a kind of future for Black politics in the world that we inhabit now. But part of my motivation in writing this book was to think about how folks who were multiply marginalized, who were facing death, the surety of death because of AIDS, still imagined future, still believed in creating new worlds through literature, through culture, through archiving themselves in literary and cultural production, and for imagining futures for those who would come after them. And so part of the hope of this book is for us to not lose hope, for us to sort of deal with that melancholy, but also to rely on one another and to sort of engage in collective practice and sort of cultural production that might generate a feeling of optimism and hope for imagining a new world.
And in the face of this melancholy, you counterpose what you call Black queer optimism.
Yeah, that optimism, I'm sort of responding to a discourse within African-American studies, both Afro-pessimism, which is partly what I was referencing in my last comment, which sees that within the afterlife of slavery, African-Americans continue to be subjected to violence because they don't really register as people, as persons. And then also responding to discourses within queer theory that see optimism as cruel, right? Because of the pervasiveness of capitalism, that we are often in search of a fantasy and we wear ourselves out trying to work for that fantasy. So I bring those discourses together in the lives of these Black gay men to imagine what Black queer optimism might look like, that even though they were facing the sort of pervasive effects of capitalism and also were not rendered as subjects or people with AIDS in that moment, that they still imagined future.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.